Hey, this is Tim from the Postmarks, and you're listening to 90.3 FM, CKUT, Montreal.
Hi, I'm Andre Goulet. You're listening to Harbinger Showcase. Harbinger Showcase is a weekly podcast syndicated to community and campus radio, including Toronto CIUT, Winnipeg CKUW, Montreal CKUT, and Vancouver Co-op Radio, and featuring highlights from the country's favorite progressive podcast community. Since launching in 2020, the Harbinger Media Network has become Canada's number one listener-supported nonprofit podcast network, featuring 66 shows exploring politics, society, and culture from a progressive perspective. Support the community for just $5 a month and get a new release from Between the Lines or Firmwood Publishing at harbingermedianetwork.com. On this episode, we're highlighting our newest wave of expansion with excerpts from three new shows. Join us as we spend two nights with the residents of Tent City for Change in St. John's on the Independence Lock and Key. Examine what progressives get right and wrong about affordable housing on the Broadbent Institute's new podcast, Perspectives. And uncover the history of the 1915-1916 Armenian Genocide on the Anti-Empire Project. That's all coming up in the next hour. But first, this episode of Harbinger Showcase is brought to you by the Alberta Advantage Podcast. Based in Calgary, this collective of more than 20 activists, academics, and journalists have been broadcasting award-winning political commentary, news, and analysis since 2017. On this excerpt from a May 2023 episode, the team ask, how are conversations about public safety and policing being mobilized to harm vulnerable people, and how does politicization of the opioid epidemic obscure what's needed to address increasing drug poisoning deaths? As harm reduction advocate, Juan Thompson joins the show to discuss the realities of the province's drug poisoning crisis.
The Alberta Advantage is a proud member of the Harbinger Media Network. This independent, listener-supported podcast is possible thanks to listeners like you. If you think what we do is important, support us with a monthly donation at patreon.com/AlbertaAdvantage. Welcome to the Alberta Advantage. I am your host, Kate Jacobson, and joining Team Advantage today, we have Roberta.
Hello.
And harm reduction advocate and writer, Ewan Thompson. Ewan, thank you so much for joining us here on the podcast.
Thanks so much for having me on. It's great to be here.
So today we're going to be talking about the opioid crisis, which should probably more appropriately be called the drug poisoning crisis. And the last time we actually discussed this on the podcast was in December of 2020, when we had Jeremy Appel and Garth Mullins on to discuss what was taking shape as the so-called Alberta model for abstinence-based treatment addiction. To give you a bit of the lay of the land here in Alberta, in the year of 2020, 1,185 Albertans died of drug poisoning. The following year, in 2021, 1,626 Albertans died of drug poisoning. And the following year, 2022, 1,498 Albertans died of drug poisoning. So that's 4,309 Albertans that have died of drug poisoning over the course of 2020 to 2022. And the reason we're using that three-year period as a measurement is that this is also the period that most people associate with the COVID-19 pandemic. And by comparison, as of March 2023, about 5,600 Albertans had died of COVID-19. Now, this is obviously a tragedy because every single one of those people had friends, family, and people who cared about them. And now they're gone for what are arguably very preventable reasons. Drug poisoning is also very much a social crisis because it puts a lot of demand on first responders, so firefighters, emergency medical services, and it also puts a lot of stress on the healthcare system. And as we all know, the healthcare system has been put under enormous pressure, both throughout the pandemic and through decades of absolute mismanagement and dismantling from both federal and provincial governments. Unfortunately, this issue hasn't received a ton of play in Alberta's provincial election, except through really unhelpful conversations around safety, public safety, and, quote, boots on the ground. Ewan, if you had to introduce the opioid and the drug poisoning crisis to someone who had absolutely no context, what are some of the most important aspects for them to understand?
I think it's really important for people to understand, first of all, that this really is a continuation of land occupation policies by settlers, in lands that were largely stolen and under kind of faulty treaty agreements that we really haven't lived up to. This crisis, as we call it, really disproportionately impacts Indigenous people in Alberta, in BC, and across the prairies. And as you kind of go from east to west across the country, the intensity of the crisis increases. And that's largely, in my view, owing to an accelerated accelerated colonialism. Over the period where we were, opening residential schools and then separating families and all the effects of these that cultural genocide that we've all agreed happened in the history of Canada, are culminating today in a lot of the effects of the drug poisoning crisis. And so in some ways you could consider it really an ongoing legacy of genocide that we have not addressed through this cultural genocide mechanism. I think that's really important. I think it's also really important for people to understand that this also disproportionately impacts workers. So we've got a huge number of people dying, inside their homes, inside their residence, as well as out on the streets. Like construction workers, other types of laborers are really disproportionately impacted because of things like, overwork, injuries at workplaces, and all the reasons that the people would normally use drugs anyway, just unwinding, but also managing pain and, trying to keep up with a really, really tough workload. So, it's rooted in this land occupation policies. It's rooted in, capitalist mentality of just driving people into the ground. And I think when we're looking at the root causes of this crisis, it's important to take those things into account.
Yeah, I saw a map recently of the United Kingdom, and it was showing like where there is opioid use, essentially, where there are large percentages of people who claim disability benefit payments. So people who are disabled and that disability prevents them from being able to find paid employment. And then also a map of where there was industrial work in the UK. So things like shipbuilding, coal mining, steelwork. And they are three identical maps. They are just the same map. And if you want to add a fourth map to it, and you look at a map of where there's really high poverty levels, really high levels of child poverty, it looks like all of the other maps. So just like what you were saying with kind of how the opioid epidemic and the drug poisoning crisis track really strongly with colonization, with areas where there's been a lot of residential schools, things like that. Opioid use also tracks very strongly with deindustrialization. Drug use tracks very strongly with financial crashes, with poverty, with not being able to find a job, all of these things.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. I think, as you say, these maps overlay really almost perfectly. And it applies to Canada as well. When we look at the history of residential schools, the concentration of residential schools from east to west across the country maps very, very closely with the intensity of drug poisoning rates across the country. BC and Yukon being the highest, Alberta being right behind them, and then kind of down the line through the prairies with decreasing intensity until you hit the Atlantic provinces. I'm not saying that there's a direct correlation here that's statistically available to us, but it's pretty clear that as colonialism was accelerated through the last 150 years, that that this did have a disproportionate impacts as you go west.
Yeah, and I'm so happy you also brought up how it disproportionately affects workers and working class people. This is something Garth brought up on the last episode that we did, because he used to be a resource worker, blue collar worker, working in mining. And he was saying that, people who work up north and like work on the rigs, work in mines, you do really intense shift work. You do it very far away from your family. When you get back to a city, when you get back to your friends, a lot of people who do that like to use drugs and they like to party and they like to unwind a little bit. And I remember one of the statistics he mentioned that was a surprise to me, based off of kind of like how how I conceptualized sort of the drug crisis based, I think, a lot off of what I absorbed from media, is he said that about half of the people who are dying from overdose are coming to it through, you know, recreational use, maybe one time, maybe a handful of times at a party or a bar or something like that, not necessarily people who are habitual daily users of any of these drugs. And obviously, even if you are a habitual daily user of a drug, that doesn't mean you deserve to die from it. Everyone deserves life, and everyone deserves a good life and access to things that keep them alive. But that was really surprising to me, because based off of how you hear Danielle Smith and Rachel Notley even really talk about this issue, they really intensely kind of cultivate this idea of like this gritty, you know, urban drug user with all the dog whistles and associated imaginings that come with it. And I do think it's important that we widen our scope of who's using drugs and who's dying from the fact that the drug supply is really poisoned.
Yeah. Like drug use is widespread across all demographics in society. There is no demographic that's, you know, free of drug poisoning risk. But we certainly have a lot more supports for folks, you know, in the upper echelons of society. And it's, you know, even mm-hmm. easier for them to access things like medical care and maybe addiction treatment care and that sort of thing. So it's not really a crisis that's necessarily born entirely by people in working classes and by Indigenous people, but the proportions certainly speak to a greater crisis in those communities, and I think that's partly intentional. You know,
absolutely.
I wrote it with Michelle Robinson, Terrell Tailfeathers, and Will Cardinal. You know, the four of us discussed quite at length, like the notion that if you were to try and design a policy that would help extend the effects of residential schools, the 60s scoop, family separation, child removal, and incarceration, really, against this mentality that's growing in our country that we need to address those past harms, then drug policy is really the number one way to do that. If you want to maintain some of those, some of that foundation that we've set in Canada for disproportionate impacts on those populations.
Well, and I think what's important about all of this is that the reality is that everybody can be affected by this drug crisis, by this mm-hmm. drug poisoning crisis. But also what we can see is that there are structural realities at play here that, often the knee-jerk reaction is to blame individuals for their own failing in this process, that, you know, somehow it's your own fault if you, get poisoned by a drug, or if you even get addicted to a drug. You know, it's framed as your own individual problem. And I think what's important here to recognize and to talk about today is that these are actually structural issues at play, that, there are individual realities going on, but it's really those structural damaging policies and effects that we can see really contributing to what has become a major crisis, across the country and across the world.
So with employers ending work from home arrangements and a large scale return to on-location work, the drug crisis has become very visible to the public. So public places, notably along public transit stations, become sites of homelessness as well as visible drug use. Now, from our perspective, our society has very few public places, very, very few shelter public places. And we have had governments who have failed to reach sensible, moderate social housing goals for decades. And in Calgary, rents have gone up by 25%. So of course, if people are homeless, they're unhoused, they're going to end up in public places and public spaces. And if we don't have a system of supervised consumption sites and supervised consumption services set up to deal with people's needs, they're going to make do with what's available, what's out of the elements, or somewhere where you're not going to die of exposure, etc. So, Ewan, could you talk to us a little bit about your read of the transit safety discourse and some of the rather awful and dehumanizing shaming that has been happening as a result?
Yeah, and I think you quite rightly point out people are being pushed out of other spaces that, you know, they had deemed safe before for their own safety, for their community's safety. And people move in communities, you know, people live in communities, unhoused populations. They have friends, they have family, they have spaces that they consider their own.
That was the Alberta Advantage. Find out more about the show at albertaadvantagepod.com and hear the rest of the conversation at harbingermedianetwork.com. You're listening to Harbinger Showcase on your local campus and community radio station. I'm Harbinger Director Andre Goulet in Montreal. Coming up next. Launched in late 2023, Lock and Key is a limited series podcast from progressive Newfoundland and Labrador media outlet The Independent, exploring housing and the stories behind closed doors with hosts Luke Quinton and Andy Bullman. On the season's first episode, the Independent editor-in-chief, Justin Brake, spends two nights at Tent City for Change in St. John's, where resident protesters were bracing for the season's first snowfall. Here's a highlight from that episode.
This is Lock and Key, a limited series podcast from the Independent Newfoundland and Labrador. And I'm Andy Bullman, one of your hosts, and I'm here with Luke Quinton, your other host and the editor of this limited series podcast. Our first episode is a little different than the other episodes. This is brought to us by Justin Brake. And Justin is going to take us into the Tent City in St. John's, Newfoundland. And you'll hear from us as the series continues.
I've just arrived at the Tent City for Change encampment in St. John's. Tent cities, or encampments, they've been popping up in cities across the country more frequently in recent years. So they're not new. We know that for most or all of the folks who live in tent cities, they've experienced homelessness or mental health crises or addiction or some other form of trauma. Or any combination of these things. Here's what else we know. They're often portrayed in a negative light by media, who tend to focus on, you know, complaints or the inconveniences that they cause to cities or the bylaws that they may be breaking.
So in terms of, you know, the city's stance, the mayor remains firm about these evictions moving forward, saying that they pose a health hazard and a risk to the public. Advocates say there has to be a better way and are hoping that their concerns are listened to.
Those same bylaws that are often used by municipalities to get a court injunction to have the encampments removed by police.
They'd been given notice to leave, but some refused to go, and things got violent.
We're doing a podcast series on housing and homelessness in Newfoundland and Labrador. And we can't do that without hearing from those who have become a symbol of just how bad the crisis is in our province. So I'm here to spend a couple days and nights with unhoused folks to better understand the circumstances they're facing and the barriers they're dealing with. It's late November when I arrive, and there's no snow on the ground. Yet. I introduce myself to several people, some of whom have been living in tents since early October, when the encampment was first established across the road from Confederation Building on Prince Philip Drive. I set up my tent among theirs, on the backside of Colonial Building, along a green wooden fence separating the provincial grounds from the city grounds of Bannerman Park. As a university student, I used to rent a room in a heritage home right across the street on Rennie's Mill Road. The street literally has mansions on it, where residents can look out their window and see Tent City. On the other side of Colonial Building, there's another mansion. This one belongs to the Lieutenant Gup, or is it Lieutenant? Anyways, the King's representative from Newfoundland and Labrador, Joan Aylward, who can also look out her window at Government House and see the two dozen or so unhoused folks living in unmansion-like conditions. Nice shack, one person says my first evening at Tent City. Wonder if she has room for a few more. Almost immediately after I arrive, people begin pulling me aside to tell me their stories. I don't record most of them. They just wanted someone to talk to. But on two occasions, I do record. Because these two women who came to me, they were adamant their stories be told. Due to the complexities of navigating government programs and services, and for other reasons that make these women vulnerable to having their names made public, we're granting them anonymity and using alternative names.
I was outside the tent, but I could hear you talking to him and telling him that you love him. And...
yeah. He was helping. He calls him Dada. He was helping Dada and Mama. He calls him Mama. He was helping Mama and Dada do the dishes. And he was taking the stuff out of the dishwasher. I was like, God's gonna rewash this now.
This is Mandy. She's been homeless for a few years now. When she was in her early 20s, she moved in with her sick mother to take care of her. Then, after her mom died, she met a man in St. John's and moved to the Avalon Peninsula to be with him. That relationship turned abusive, though, and she was eventually forced to make a harrowing escape with the help of police. But that meant having nowhere else to go, so she found herself at the Naomi Center, a St. John's shelter for young women. Eventually, she got her own place and started dating another man. Another man who also turned out to be abusive. And Mandy found herself on the streets again.
I was between couch surfing, sleeping on the streets, park benches, anywhere I could sleep, literally eating out of garbage cans. Going downtown, and when people was throwing out all them foods, I used to take it so I could eat. I did that for 2 years. Between couch surfing and living on the streets eating out of garbage.
Then she met a new partner, and then Mandy got pregnant. But that relationship too was abusive, and she had to leave to keep her and her unborn baby safe. But as she'd learn, being a single mom without a place to live, she'd be forced to go to Child, Youth, and Family Services, or CYFS.
I ended up spending 2 or 3 months in that hospital before my son was born. I was always told I couldn't have children, so I didn't know what I wanted to do. But once he was born, I knew I wanted to try to raise him if I could. But then he was born, I was homeless, nowhere for him to live. I couldn't take him in a tent or on the streets. So I decided to put him in the care of CYFS in hopes that I would get housing and possibility he would be coming home. So I ended up getting a beautiful 2-bedroom house. CYFS told me if I had my house a year, because I was almost 4 years homeless, if I could keep a stable housing for a year, my son would be returned back to me.
But just when Mandy thought she was safe and on track to have stable housing for a year, she was blindsided by her landlord, who told her he wanted to up the rent.
I told him, well, you have to wait for a year and then give me a 6-month notice. Then he said, well, I'm not waiting a year. I never signed no contract. It was month to month. He said he was going to give me a 3-month eviction if I wasn't willing to go sooner. So I told him that I would need at least 4 months to be able to come up with the rent he wanted. So that's when he came and gave me the 3-month non-eviction notice. I went from couch surfing to back to living in tents and on the streets, begging for money for food, heating out of garbage cans once again, something I didn't think I would have to do. Then I had to make a very hard decision. They were only giving me a year. I knew at that point, once I became homeless again, there was probably not going to be a chance because I need to find another place. So I had no other option. If I wanted to still be in his life and see him and have an open adoption, it was best to give it up for adoption. So I made the hardest decision to give him up on one condition. He will go to his godparents.
Mandy has a hard time talking about this, obviously. It's re-traumatizing her just to share her story. But she really wants her story to be told because she wants others to know that landlords have this much power over people's lives. They have the ability to force people onto the streets, to put them in situations where they're eating out of garbage cans, and they can force young mothers into making one of the most dreaded decisions they could ever have to make, all because they know there are others who will pay more. And it's not just her. Mandy says she's met 6 other mothers who've been put in the same situation.
I have talked to 6 other mothers that had to either put their kids with family members for custody or put them up for adoption.
Because they couldn't get
because
stable housing.
Because they could not get the stable access. And that's only 6 that I am known of.
Mandy also has health complications. In fact, the morning after our interview and after spending one of the coldest nights in her tent, she had multiple seizures, was ambulanced to the hospital, medicated, and released back onto the streets. Now she's back at the encampment and back to sleeping on the cold ground. On my first day at Tent City, I noticed some folks in plain clothes. They're speaking with residents and writing in their notepads. As I'm putting up my tent, one of them comes over and introduces himself. He's with Thrive. Thrive is a community organization that helps vulnerable people get connected with the government or community agencies that can best meet their needs. We shake hands and I tell him I'm a journalist. He offers to help me put up my tent. I say thanks, but I'm all good, and he goes back to speaking with residents. But Thrive being here in the encampment, it makes me wonder why, if community groups are on the ground here doing the work they do, why are there more than 2 dozen people still here? End Homelessness St. John's is another community group with boots on the ground here. They work with public and community stakeholders on system-wide planning to prevent and end homelessness in the capital city.
What we're trying to effectively do is coordinate all of the resources that any individual who might be experiencing homelessness can access.
This is Doug Pawson, Executive Director of End Homelessness St. John's.
And I would say over the last 18 to 24 months has been, you know, that system being fully strained, fully tapped out, full caseloads for case management services, shelters, you know, exploding in numbers and demand. On top of that, you've got the cost of living crisis and the housing crisis. And really, you've got a housing crisis and a healthcare crisis, kind of like it's a confluence of these events. And what's happening is the most vulnerable neighbors of ours get squeezed out of housing. They don't get access to the kind of mental health or addiction services that they might need or primary health services. And so you've got a full system that's operating at capacity, and it's not able to serve the growing demand that's being placed on it because governments for decades have just not invested in housing. They've not invested in mental health and healthcare. And as a result, here we are today where people are the most vulnerable we've ever seen and their needs are the most acute we've ever seen. And there's just not enough responses for those needs.
While community groups are showing up to help, the bulk of support for Tent City for Change are the neighbors and community volunteers. Folks like Lee Turner.
I'm Lee Turner, and I'm just like one of the non-resident protesters here. So trying to do some activist work around housing and securing long-term accessible housing for the folks and the residents here at Tent City.
Turner works in research and innovation with Newfoundland and Labrador Health Services.
I got involved because I was just seeing what was going on and offering to bring food and supplies and whatever else I could. And I started building relationships with the residents and then just got into the volunteer group. And we've been, you know, working all together ever since so we can build capacity and really make sure that the residents here get, first of all, long-term accessible housing, but also all of the survival needs that they have now that are met through the volunteers and the communities.
In the 2 nights I spend at Tent City, it seems like there's a steady flow of volunteers coming and going. Some of them are regulars, and others just residents or business owners or members of church groups, dropping off a box of coffee or a tray of mac and cheese. It's clear that there are many people in St. John's who care about the folks here and who want to help. But Tent City's been around for 2 months now. And tonight, the season's first snowfall. Fortunately for the resident protesters here, volunteers brought a large tent with a wood stove. They burn firewood and crowd into the tent to keep warm. But there's only space for so many at a time, so they take turns. Around 10:30, I pack it in for the night and retreat to my tent. I have an air mattress, two sleeping bags, and a base layer of clothes. But even with that, I wake up in the middle of the night and I'm chilled to the bone. By sunrise, I feel like complete crap. I can't imagine doing this every night. When I get up, I head to Tim's and grab a couple boxes of coffee for the residents. Then I check my email and socials, and I find out it's actually National Housing Day in Canada. The day was created in 2000 after an advocacy group called the Toronto Disaster Relief Committee declared homelessness to be a national disaster 2 years earlier in 1998. The group released a state of emergency declaration calling for all levels of government to invest 1% of their budgets into building social housing. The declaration was endorsed by people, community groups, churches, labor unions, and even some government agencies. Then finally, in 2017, nearly two decades later, this.
Years of hard work have culminated in the National Housing Strategy, a robust, comprehensive, life-changing plan to help Canadians get into homes and stay there. The National Housing Strategy represents a once-in-a-generation $40 billion vision of how we can protect the affordability of the current affordable housing stock in Canada, build four times as many units in the past decade, prepare three times as many units as the past decade.
That was an excerpt from the first episode of Lock and Key from The Independent in Newfoundland and Labrador. Find out more at theindependent.ca, at harbingermedianetwork.com, or wherever you get your podcasts. Coming up next. Since launching in May 2023, Perspectives, a journal of political economy and social democracy, has brought left-wing thought and inquiry into public debates and policy for building a just and equitable Canada with host Clement Nokos in Toronto. On this excerpt from a December episode, Clem sits down with Professor Carolyn Witzman to discuss her Globe and Mail piece, Canada's Progressive Parties Have Lost the Plot on the Housing Crisis, in a conversation explaining why progressive politicians should talk about housing in terms of industrial strategy and the role of government in building more housing supply. Here's a highlight from that conversation.
But then at the end of the video, Mr. Polyevra sort of ends up by saying, and the answer to all of this is no government spending. And you almost get whiplash because everything he said actually talks about the need for some kind of intervention. Even when the Conservatives say we are going to set targets and link it to infrastructure money for municipalities, that's government intervention. So the notion that cutting government spending is a magic bullet solution bears no resemblance to the rest of the video.
Welcome to Perspectives, a Canadian journal of political economy and social democracy. I'm Clement Nokos, editor of Perspectives Journal and director of policy and engagement at the Broadbent Institute. I sat down before the December 2023 holidays to speak to Professor Carolyn Witzman, housing and social policy consultant, an expert advisor to the Housing Assessment Resource Tools Project at the University of British Columbia, and an adjunct professor at the University of Ottawa's Department of Geography, Environment, and Geomatics, to ask her, just what are Canadian progressives getting wrong and right about housing affordability? This past summer, she wrote a piece in the Globe and Mail entitled Canada's Progressive Parties Have Lost the Plot on the Housing Crisis. Responding to Prime Minister Justin Trudeau's blunt statement earlier that summer that housing is simply not a federal responsibility. In her piece, she asked, what's with the silence from allegedly more progressive parties on the doubling of the quantum of non-market housing, a policy that has been recommended by everyone from the industry body for community housing to one of Canada's big banks? She also asks, why not talk about housing in terms of industrial policy, something that we do love to talk about here at Perspectives Journal, and the role of government in building more housing supply instead of trying to outflank Pierre Poilievre's inconsistent policy slogans from the right wing? And since then, Conservative leader Pierre Poilievre has stated that governments should get out of home building even after Prime Minister Trudeau already confirmed that. So clearly, getting government into home building isn't what's behind the present affordability crisis we all face today. And meanwhile, progressives have yet to propose big plans to get government back into housing, while two-thirds of Canadians, polled by Leger in early December, said that they wanted the federal government to spend more money on its housing strategy. But in recent months, a number of new spending announcements and policy changes have come out of Social Democratic administrations in British Columbia and Toronto, talking about big spends and policy changes to jumpstart building out the supply for decommodified non-market housing. Is this even close enough? And what exactly are progressives getting wrong and right about housing affordability? Professor Weitzman, thank you for joining me for this dialogue on the Perspectives Journal podcast to help me answer these questions.
Happy to be here, Clement.
So to start, I think what bears repeating, though it's been often discussed, is the definition of affordable housing, for clarification.
Well, the human rights definition of affordable housing is housing costs that don't stop you from other necessities like food or transport or education. Around the world, for instance, the OECD, the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development, defines affordable housing as no more than 30% of pre-tax household income or no more than 40% of post-tax household income. That's a arbitrary number, but the advantage of that number is it's been measured by the census since 1991. It's a measure that is used around the world. One of the tricks, though, is that the CMHC used to, and by used to, I mean from the beginnings of the CMHC in the 1940s until the abandonment of housing policy by the federal government, used income categories. So it looked at the lowest quintile of household income and said, these are low-income people, that they have the biggest housing problems. And then they looked at the next quintile and they said, these are moderate-income people. We need to make sure, for instance, that there are rental, market rental and home ownership options that are affordable for them. And one of the real disappointments of the current reentry into affordable housing is that we're not talking about who needs affordable housing, where and at what cost. And we can't really do that without getting beyond a concept of sort of middle income affordability and starting to dig down into low and moderate income affordability.
And so in addition to the nuances behind the definition of quote unquote affordable housing, you also have policymakers debate terms like non-market housing, what some may call public housing. And then you also have the ideas of financialization, commodification, and decommodification of housing. How do you go about explaining and nuancing these particular terms? And how do they fit in the idea of affordable housing?
I'll start off with a basic division, which is between market housing, sometimes called private development, that is driven by profit, and non-market housing, which is at least supposed to be driven by public good. So if there are any profits, they're sort of plowed back into more affordable housing. So that would include public housing. Public housing is anything that's owned by a level of government. Usually in Canada these days, it's municipal housing. Then there's cooperative housing. And in Canada, that usually means housing that is co-owned by the tenants and run in a nonprofit way. In other words, you don't need to buy anything to live in the co-op. You don't get anything when you move out of a co-op. And then the third category would be what's internationally called community housing. But in Canada, there's a whole bunch of different terms for it. But basically, it's housing provided by a nonprofit organization and usually includes supportive housing, which is housing that has health and social supports attached to the housing. So there's market housing, and that is 95% of housing in Canada. And then there's non-market housing, which is a very small stump. It's like 5% of housing in Canada. When we talk about commodification or financialization, what it really means is housing that is intended to make profits, be high return investments, as opposed to homes as a place for people to live in. So again, that's 95% of the housing in Canada.
And on that distinction between the 95% of market housing in Canada versus the very small proportion of non-market housing, I see this tension between the need for profits among some who believe that's what drives housing supply in Canada and the requisite need for housing to be a human right. And so how does a housing policy advocate like yourself approach that contention between profits and human rights?
Well, look, I've always come at urban issues from the perspective of human rights. So housing is an odd thing. It is a human right. The National Housing Strategy Act of 2019 says it's a right. But unlike, let's say, healthcare in Canada, or education in Canada, the majority of which is provided on a non-market, non-profit basis through the government, housing is primarily provided by the private market. A little bit like food is a necessity. There is a right to life, which would include adequate food, but most of it's produced by the private sector. In that case, it's the job of the government to make sure that everyone has access to that right. So what that means in terms of non-market housing is it's, again, since the 1940s, the Canadian government has been accepting the fact that for the lowest income 20% of the population, there aren't any good private market solutions. So there does need to be a substantial amount of non-market housing. In the 1940s, the first major report on housing said a third of all new housing should be non-market. In France, there's been targets for municipalities to have 20% non-market housing since 2000. That's been true whether it's a right-wing government or a left-wing government. So there does need to be much more non-market housing than there is. And the abandonment of non-market housing in the 1990s coincides and really causes the growing tide of homelessness. When it comes to the private sector housing, on the one hand, you can't just say, wow, all developers are evil, because to me, it would be like saying, gee, I don't have a doctor, so all doctors must be evil. Well, let's put it this way. I think that landlords need to be licensed. I think there need to be rules. I think we need to protect the rights of both tenants and home buyers. So that's part of the right to housing. And so what we need to do with private development is not make it jump through hoops. And this is true even more so for non-market housing, which is made to jump through ridiculous hoops, treated as an unwelcome unicorn every time it comes up. But that's also true of market housing at the moment. It's like every new development's treated like, oh my God, how is it going to pay for the terrible things it's doing to the surrounding community, instead of housing being a good thing and more of housing being a good thing. So one thing that really vexes me or worries me, and I think it worries a lot of people, is the fact that we are actually producing fewer homes in 2022 than we did in 1972, 50 years ago, when the population of Canada was about half what it is today, and households were larger. That is objectively a huge supply problem. And although absolutely we should be prioritizing increasing non-market supply, we also need to increase market supply, because otherwise we're not going to get lower rents, any kind of lower housing costs with 0% vacancy rates. We aren't going to get housing first with 0% vacancy rates.
Now, I'm sure you've seen this documentary video conservative leader Pierre Poilievre recently released entitled Housing Hell, and in it he documents the challenges and experiences ordinary Canadians face with this housing affordability crisis. But his policy prescription basically says we need to get government out of housing, even though for decades the federal government has washed its hands of housing. What do you make of these conservative perspectives on the housing crisis?
Well, in a sense, I think Mr. Poilievre is responding to something that's desperately needed, which are some simple explainers on a lot of the jargon that we just talked about, like affordable housing for whom, what does non-market housing be? I think that there is a lot of public interest in housing right now, and a lot of what we talk about is surrounded by jargon. So I want to begin by saying having a 5-minute explainer out there, great. there are some people who are producing really good short explainers. And I think people are using YouTube and TikTok and all kinds of social media platforms in order to get their information. So that's great. I would love to see the NDP and the Liberals doing that as well. I'd love to see advocacy groups doing that more effectively. It's an odd video because it starts off by using a lot of talking points that have been brought up by various housing researchers, including talking about Singapore as a great exemplar. Well, the thing about Singapore is when it won independence from Britain in 1964, the government saw a huge housing shortage, and it responded by appropriating most of the land in Singapore. 90% of the land in Singapore is owned by the Singapore government. 80% of people in Singapore live in public housing. It is public housing that's sold, but because the government owns land rights in a mechanism that's similar to what in Canada we call a community land trust, they can determine the price, they can determine the allocation. They've determined allocation by, for instance, ethnicity. They don't want developments that are all Chinese origin people or all Malaysian origin people or all Indian origin people. So when Mr. Polyever brings that up as an example, I actually think that that's much more interventionist than I've heard any party ever talk about. But of course, he doesn't follow it through. He doesn't say, yep, let's appropriate all land and let's allocate all housing according to need. And let's make sure that every development is ethnically mixed, because I don't think that fits in with the conservative ideology.
That was Perspectives, a journal of political economy and social democracy from the Broadbent Institute. Find out more at perspectivesjournal.ca and at harbingermedianetwork.com. You're listening to Harbinger Showcase on your local community and campus radio station. I'm Andre Goulet in Montreal. Up next. Since 2016, the Anti-Empire Project from Toronto academic Justin Potter has been exploring how today's empire works, with a focus on the Global South and featuring analytical tools like geopolitics, development, political economy, and history. On an excerpt from a recent episode, Justin looks at the 1915-16 Armenian genocide, exploring how genocides happen in broad daylight and are only covered up afterwards. Here's a highlight from that episode.
All right, Dave, we are back with episode 34 of World War Civ. This is a particularly harrowing and tragic episode. If people, what can I say? Just, I guess I have to give that warning. We're talking about the Armenian genocide of 1915 and 1916 here. Yep. So this is, I didn't want to not do this. Otherwise, we would be like, what, 150 countries of the world that don't acknowledge that this happened. You were just saying, Dave.
That was my biggest surprise researching this. There are only 31 countries in the world that recognize that this actually happened.
So the politics of the Turkish, the foreign policy of the Turkish government, I suppose, for the past 100 years, has been, if you want to have good relations with us, we don't talk about this, I suppose.
Right.
So what's it? Yeah. I mean, there's so many things. We'll get into all of it. But I wanted to say that, you know, this is 1915-16. So we've already talked about this period in other contexts. We've talked about Gallipoli and the Dardanelles invasions. We've talked about the Sykes-Picot Agreement. These were all, if you go back to the World War Civ episodes where we talked about those things, you should just know that this is happening at the same time as those mm-hmm. things are happening. So this is Ottoman Turkey during World War One, and all of we're covering different aspects of the war so that we can make sure that we stay in sync. We don't want to get too far ahead or behind chronologically as we go. So I wanted to say I was using a couple of sources, but the one I relied on the most is Taner Akçam, I think is how you pronounce it, T-A-N-E-R, and then the last name is A-K-C-A-M. So Taner Akçam, and Taner Akçam has written a bunch of books, like 4 or 5 books about the Armenian genocide. So I don't know, I'm not This is not an area, Dave, where, like I've said this many times before about Turkey, like I don't have a lot of personal connections to Turkey. I've never been to Turkey. I don't have a lot of personal connections to Armenia. It's just reading for me. Like, it's just what I've read. It's just research for me.
Okay. Well, I've been to Turkey for a short visit, and I have to say that I was very, very impressed. Mm-hmm. Certainly among the most hospitable people in the world that I've ever met. So it's hard to reconcile these things.
Yeah, I mean, geopolitics and regime politics are totally different, right?
So, yeah, yeah.
So Tanner, I gather, is Turkish, and not Armenian, but like Turkish, whatever that means, and lives in Germany, I believe. Is a professor in Germany, so it's an academic approach, very academic work in the good sense too, like lots of footnotes and very careful appraisal of sources and very careful and explicit evaluation of things. So it's as someone who's not knowledgeable about this, it's great to read someone like that because it's so transparent about where it's coming from. And Akçam is kind of a dissident Turkish person. He's been imprisoned for a variety of things. He was imprisoned for activism on the Kurdish question. So he's known as someone who's pro-Kurdish as a Turk. There are lots of Turkish people that are like this, and Turkish intellectuals. He was a good friend of a journalist named Hrant Dink, who I think is pretty famous in Turkish intellectual and activist circles, who was assassinated in 2007. That same year, Taner Akçam was detained in Canada and in the U.S. when he was traveling, and it was essentially for doing this work on the Armenian genocide. So I guess the Turkish government accuses him of all kinds of things, and other governments that want to stay on Turkey's good side have done various little things to discredit his work. So the main book that I'm using here is called The Young Turks: Crime Against Humanity, The Armenian Genocide and Ethnic Cleansing in the Ottoman Empire, which is from 2012, and it's by Princeton University Press. And there are a couple of other books by the same author that I also used. One is a edited book called Judgment at Istanbul, the Armenian Genocide Trials, referring to the 1919-20 trials. We'll briefly mention these at the end. Mm-hmm. And another book called From Empire to Republic, Turkish Nationalism and the Armenian Genocide. So there's, like I said, Taner Akçam has written a lot on this topic. So the overall analysis in The Young Turks: Crime Against Humanity is that the politics at the time, we're still living in this era in a sense, their regime hasn't changed its official view. There were two framings. The way the Armenian minority and other minorities see it are minorities who were happy to see the fall of the Ottoman Empire because they saw the fall of the Ottoman Empire as giving them their national rights, potentially. And then there's the Turkish national view, which is that the imperialists were out to get Turkey and dismantle Turkey and dismember Turkey. And the minorities, including the Armenians, were being used as tools by the imperialists in that objective. So obviously, I think we should say these are both true. These are both views that are understandable and fairly cogent, logical views that can be taken on what's going on and what was going on in this period of Turkish and world history. So Taner, again, and Taner is someone he's able to kind of hold these views despite not endorsing them. So he talks about the Turkish nationalist view. He says, from the Turkish nationalist point of view, the Armenian genocide was, quote, a tragic but unintended byproduct of the war. And the Turkish nationalist view is that there's no reliable evidence of a deliberate policy of systemic killing. In this view, the only source of reliable evidence on the topic is the Prime Ministerial Ottoman Archive in Istanbul. Foreign archives like British, German, American, and Austrian, as well as the domestic proceedings of the Istanbul court martial, are dismissed as politically motivated distortions of the events. And on the other hand, so that's the end of the quote, and on the other hand, people who claim genocide dismiss the Ottoman records as falsified. And so what Akçam is trying to do in his book is argue that actually, when you look at the archives together, he says they, quote, jointly confirm that the ruling party, CUP, Committee of Union and Progress, did deliberately implement a policy of ethno-religious homogenization of Anatolia, which is the, what would you call Anatolia? Like Turkey. I don't know how to put it exactly, but like
modern. Yeah.
Like the Ottoman Empire is Turkey plus all these other areas, and Turkey, what you would call Turkey is Anatolia, the Anatolian peninsula. Is it a peninsula?
Kind of. Yeah. It's the Turkish heartland. Yeah. Anyway.
Yeah. So an ethno-religious homogenization of Anatolia that aimed to destroy the Armenian population. So Akçam is arguing that you don't need to skip one or another set of sources to conclude that this was a genocidal policy. You can actually study things carefully and realize that it was, in fact, a genocide.
Well, it's a polite way of saying don't draw your conclusions without reading some of the information.
Yeah, without reading the other side. Yeah.
Well, I mean, the whole denial thing is interesting because the Ottoman Empire had so many prior cases of doing the same things.
Yeah.
So I found out, I did not know this, but the Armenians were spread not just in modern day Armenia, but they were spread all over Anatolia and heavily concentrated in eastern Anatolia. And many of these Armenian villages were under Kurdish landlords.
There's a big Kurdish Armenian problem in the areas where there are big Armenian populations. I read something about like six districts or something.
Yeah,
like six key districts.
Yeah, but part of the problem is that the Ottomans basically eliminated the Kurdish emirates in the middle of the 19th century. And that meant that they wanted those Armenian villages to pay their taxes to the central government. But the Kurdish landlords weren't willing to give up that revenue, so they insisted on still being paid. So now the Armenian population are paying taxes to two separate overlords. In the 1890s, there were forced conversions and the Hamidian massacres. So we did an episode on the Young Turks and spent a bunch of time on Sultan Abdulhamid, lovely guy. But he saw the Armenians as possible threat, danger, and was all too happy to stir up.
That was an excerpt from a recent episode of the Anti-Empire Project with Justin Podor. Find it at podor.org. This episode of Harbinger Showcase has been brought to you by the Alberta Advantage. Find out more about Calgary's number one podcast at albertaadvantagepod.com. Subscribe to the Harbinger newsletter for weekly updates on new episodes from Canada's cross-country community of more than 60 socially and politically progressive podcasts. Support our work for as little as $5 a month, and we'll send you a free new release from Between the Lines Books or Fernwood Publishing. Find out more at harbingermedianetwork.com. Music on this episode is courtesy of Creative Commons. Stay tuned for another episode of Harbinger Showcase on this station next week. I'm Harbinger director Andre Goulet in Montreal. Now back to your regularly scheduled community radio station programming.
Malcolm McDowell. Yes, it really is. And you are listening to Sea Cut. So, hey, you have been warned.
Oui, les enfants.
Qu'est-ce qu'on va faire cette année pour la semaine de relâche?
Bien, nous allons aller glisser.
Encore?
Maman, on fait toujours ça.
Mais qu'est-ce qu'on peut faire d'autre?
Euphoria!
C'est quoi ça, Euphoria?
Euphoria offre des activités éducatives et théâtre aux enfants pour la semaine de relâche.
Oui, maman. Jeudi le 7 mars, au complexe La Providence de midi à 18h. Il y aura 10 kiosques d'ateliers gratuits. Peinture, sculpture, couture, confection de bijoux, bricoréno, jeux de société, Lego, danse, cuisine et jeux gonflables. Tout cela gratuitement.
Waouh!
Et vendredi le 8 mars au centre Leonardo da Vinci, 2 pièces de théâtre. Le chat beauté à 13h pour les bouchous de 3 à 6 et Bouki et Malice à 16h pour les 7 à 13 ans. Seulement $30 pour adultes et enfants.
Alors, qu'est-ce qu'on fait cette année pour la semaine de relâche?
Euphoria!
Billets en vente partout et sur Eventbrite. Info 438-994-7615. 438-994-7615.
Yay!
You're listening to CKUT. The following is a previously broadcast program. Stay tuned.
Sleepy King starts now.